this collaboration with the University of Athens. Obviously, the flagship university in the country. Previous Athens lectures have been taking place in collaboration with significant institutions in the country, for example, the National Bank of Greece. But this is the in the revival of the series, we bring the LSE Athens Lecture Series into an academic venue, and we want this to be something that continues into the future. We're talking with the University of Athens for a number of possible research collaborations, also collaborations in the educational mission of the two institutions, as well as, I have to say, as LSE and as Hellenic Observatory with other places, other universities, academic institutions in Greece. So it is really a great moment for us that we're able to relaunch the LSE Athens Lecture Series, the three lectures in this academic year's series. You probably received the leaflet with the information, but stay tuned. We do a lot of other events, both in Greece and in London, if you happen to be there. And we try to inform policy and public dialogue, not only with our lectures, but also with other activities that we do. Professor Samitas, the Vice Rector, introduced the speakers, so I will not say much in terms of introduction, but just to say that it's really a great moment to have one of the most well-known behavioral scientists to speak to us about a concept which is maybe a bit controversial, but it's definitely something that speaks to something which is very contemporary, very important, about ideational polarization, about, if you want, societal fragmentation and so forth. And as a discussant, Dr. Labrini Rory, who has written widely and studied a lot issues, similar issues in the political spectrum for this country. So I'm very, very pleased to have both speakers here. Before I pass on the floor to our guest speaker, Professor Dolan, I would like to say a few thanks. We opted to have the Athens Lecture Series in collaboration with a university, and we had to make it work in a number of ways, including financially. So we're very, very extremely thankful to our sponsors, Alpha Bank, Metlen Energy Metals, and Piraeus Bank, who are sponsoring the series, as well as the supporters, Eurobank, who is one of our supporters as well, sponsoring the series. But I have to say a special thanks also to the LSE Hellenic Alumni Association and the president, Mr. Kalabokis, who is here with us. The Alumni Association has supported the Hellenic Observatory in its mission for many, many years. In previous incarnations of the Athens Lecture Series, we were collaborating in the organization, and we feel that we are still working together for this incarnation of the Athens Lecture Series. We're very thankful to our sponsors, to the Alumni Association, to the University of Athens, and the Rector, the Vice Rector, for all the support, but we're especially thankful to that piece of the Athenian society, if you want, that honors us with your presence, and you participate, let's say, from the other side on this dialogue about important issues that we think are important for Greece. So I say on the other side, but you will get the opportunity to ask your questions. We will have the lecture by Professor Dolan, and then the discussion by Dr. Rory, but then we'll open it up to the audience for your questions, and we'll have a bit of a discussion with the panel. So without further ado, and sorry for taking too much of your time, thank you very much for coming here, and let me pass the floor to the speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Vasilis Monastiriotis. Now we are very pleased to welcome Professor Paul Dolan, Professor of Behavioral Science and the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science of the London School of Economics and Political Science.
Good evening. It's an absolute honour to be here. You could have picked a nicer room, though. This is a little bit understated for me, to be honest. But next time. No, thank you. Honestly, it's an absolute joy to be here. So I have a book out. My publisher would always, insist that I promote the book as much as possible. And so basically buy it. That's the simple. I don't care if you read it. It would be nice if you did. It would be an added bonus. But buying it is really all the publisher cares about. So there's a barcode for those that wish to buy Beliefism, which I will come on to talk about in obviously more detail shortly. But there is the definition, discrimination against people with different beliefs to us. And so I'm trying to make this, Greek relevant. And so there's someone else has a book out this week, in fact, Alexis Tsipras. Some of you may have heard of him. I want to just take a show of hands to begin with. I just want to, first of all, I'm going to ask you whether you, and I'm going to do all of the things that I'm going to suggest shortly that we should never do, which is to polarize positions. But for simplicity, you only have two options. You either see Alexis Tsipras as one of us or one of them, as friend or as foe, as good or as evil, as right or as wrong. Okay? So I want you to put your hand up if you are with Alexis Tsipras, and then I'll ask you to put your hand up if you're without. And you have to be one or the other. There is no middle ground to begin with. There'll be some middle ground later on. But first of all, put your hand up if you are a friend of Alexis Tsipras. Wow. Okay. So that means that's a very interesting audience. So hands up if you are a foe of Alexis Tsipras. Well, come on, you've got to put your hand up to one or the other. You have to put your hand up to one or the other. Friend, foe. Did you know that about your colleagues and about the audience? Okay, so put your hands up again. Put your hands up again if you are a foe, because there's very few friends. So we'll start with the foes. Put your hands up. Up, 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 up. Up. Guys, like an LSE student class. Put your hands up if you are a foe. Okay, a foe. Now, keep your hand up if you are going to read the book. And be honest. I don't believe you. I do believe you. That's a very good thing. Because, of course, once we decide that somebody is one of us or one of them, we then use that thin slice of information about somebody to categorize their entire character as being good or bad, to either agree with pretty much everything they do or say, or to disagree entirely with everything they do or say. To the extent that sometimes we might not know what we believe about something until we hear who it is that's saying it, and we've already decided that someone is either one of us or one of them, and then we can decide on the basis of that information whether we agree with the particular issue or not. And so much of, I feel like so much of my behavioral science work, particularly and including my work on happiness, is a message for the human condition to get over itself, for us all to get over ourselves about so many things that are fundamental truths of the human condition. And one fundamental truth of the human condition is that we like a simple world that has a binary between us and them, between good and evil, between friend and foe, right or wrong. Moral dualism has been around forever, and it makes life very simple for us. Because ambivalence, uncertainty, complexity, context, they're all things that make the brain work hard, and we are inherently lazy creatures who like simplicity. So once I find out something about you, say an issue that's important on an issue that's important to me, it's so much easier if I just decide whether you are one of us or one of them. And to dismiss nuance and ambivalence and uncertainty. And don't pretend or think that you're not like that, because you are a human being, presumably, who has been wired in every sense of that word, and I often use that word inadvisedly amongst neuroscientists in particular, but we're wired to be able to identify people in those ways. When you first see somebody, in the first split second, you are already coding whether that person is likely to be friend or foe. Huge evolutionary advantage in us doing that. So don't pretend that we don't do it. It makes life simple for us. We like a simple life. It makes it easy for us. The problem is that that thin slice of information is not always a very good representation of someone's entire character, or indeed whether we should listen to them or believe what they have to say. And you can all think of many environments where you may do that, where other people that you know do that. Well, actually, it's mostly other people, isn't it? Put your hand up if you think you are an intolerant person. An intolerant person. Thank you so much. The honesty of two people in a room, or three people in a room of however many. Because people will always say, I'm really tolerant. And then they'll pause for a moment and go, well, except for... And then they reel off a list of all the people that they hate. We're all tolerant when it comes to political polarization, but not just political polarization, any form of polarization. It's the other side that's always succumbing to fake news, misinformation. They're the ones that need to be listening to more arguments from my side, not the other way around. But here's the thing. Think for a moment about anything that you think you know to be true. Do you actually know it to be true? I mean, how much do you actually know? I mean, you could pick almost any issue. Let's take one that's close to the heart of an economist. Has income inequality over the last two decades increased, decreased, or remained unchanged? Now, actually, let me ask you that question. You don't have to be an economist to have a view on this. Do you think, and let's just make it increased or decreased, do you think income inequality has increased over the last couple of decades? Put your hand up if you think the answer to that question is yes. Put your hand up if you think the answer to that question is no. Interesting. Interesting because, of course, that's an empirical question, right? It is a question in principle that is answerable by empirical data. So why would we be divided on the answer to that question? Well, simply because there's lots of ways of imputing and understanding income inequality, not least of which is how to deal with missing data. So you make different assumptions, you can get different conclusions. For what it's worth, the consensus amongst most economists now would be that income inequality, using the Gini coefficient, has decreased over the last couple of decades. In spite of that, there is huge vitriol amongst economists about the answer to that question of fact. Imagine what it's like on questions of value, for which there is no empirical answer. There can be no empirical answer to that question. You believe something because, well, you trust the people that tell you to believe it. Not because you know. You can't know about the Gini coefficient as a statement of fact. You can't even know about climate science unless you're a climate scientist. Why do you believe that we've got man-made climate problems as an issue? Because you believe the people telling you there is. If you think that your beliefs are based on information, knowledge, and rationality, even in a university, you're probably not anywhere near as clever as you might think you are. The most fundamental determinants of what you believe are nature, nurture, norms, and exposure. Essentially, the social ties that hold us together. You believe the things that people around you believe, the people that you trust to be telling you the truth. You search out sources of information, find information that satisfy those beliefs. Information and knowledge come quite a long way down the list of fundamental determinants of our beliefs. Which is kind of good and bad in a way, because it would of course be cognitively demanding, to say the least, to try to find out everything about everything that you could possibly believe. So the shortcuts are actually very helpful. And don't underestimate those shortcuts. So even in the US, you know, we talk about the US as being an incredibly polarized country. Some really cool research from Harvard by a guy called Vincent Pons, who's showing that when people move between predominantly Republican to Democrat areas and vice versa, there's about an 8% change, is it, George, in the first year of moving with political allegiance. You become like the people that you are around. the social ties that hold us together. Our beliefs are, in large part, our social ties. Now, 8%, you could say, is not very much. It's enough to swing an election. So if everybody moved in one direction, it would change an election result. That seems pretty significant. Even in something that you might think you hold to be dear. Because we are social animals. I can't emphasize enough how much we want to be like people like us. And when you get over yourself about that, you're then able to, it frees you to some degree to be able, perhaps, to listen a bit more to alternative perspective and to understand why those crazy people that hold those mad views hold them. Because they hold them for precisely the same reasons you do, because of the bonds and the social ties that hold your community together, using that term community very widely and broadly. So, I want to just say just a few words before I move on to talk about what we might do about this and leaving plenty of opportunity for discussion. To say a few words about how beliefism spillovers manifest themselves in green. I want to just emphasize this point about how substantive this problem is. And I'm going to just draw on one piece of experimental evidence. There's lots of data from the field, and I should, at this point, thank George Melios, who's in the audience here, who is, I say, Georgios Melios, who's obviously Greek. He is another wonderful Greek academic who worked with me on the Beliefism book and helped me find lots of the evidence that substantiate most of what I say, 200-plus references in the book, largely thanks to George. You imagine you're in an experimental condition where you're trying to make as much money as you can by coding shapes. And you get paid if you get the correct shape. They're just made up shapes. They're just randomly chosen shapes. But you then get expert advice from people who give you information on whether this is, I think it's called a blap, right, is the name of the shape. It's a made up name. And you take the expert advice, and experts obviously give you good advice about which shape is or is not. And then you're given information on the partisanship of the expert. If you're a Democrat, you listen much more to Democratic advice about the shape. If you're a Republican, you listen much more to Republican advice about the shape, neither of which is in any way correlated to their expertise. Because what becomes more relevant to you than the knowledge that they might have is whether they are affiliated to the same political party as you. So it's not just that we split on people, it's just not that we identify people as good or bad. It plays out in economic behaviors, and there, when you do actually read the book after having bought it, you'll see lots of examples of where it plays out in economic decisions, where it matters for markets, whether you, you know, how you behave is determined by factors that should be wholly irrelevant to making a good economic decision. So, I have no idea what time I should have paid attention to the time. How long have I been talking?
Doing well with time.
10 minutes, 15? God, isn't time? Time is flying by. Good. Okay. Well, I've got lots of time. I can relax. I've got another. You said I can talk for 2 hours. Is that right? Is that what? I will talk for about half an hour. That's what I'm about halfway through. So perfect. So this is setting up the problem and the challenge. And we can discuss, you know, for example, I'm not trying to preempt questions, but there's bound to be a question about the role that social media plays in all of this, for example. So we can deal with that in the Q&A. And there'll be other things that I'm sure will come to mind as we go through. But what I want to do is now make a central statement that is really the fundamental motivation for all of this work and should be a fundamental motivation for all that you might do in related areas, which is the following. Well-functioning societies celebrate difference. I'll say it again. Well-functioning societies celebrate difference. We would never have evolved to be here today if we were all the same. Imagine a simple dimension like risk appetite. Imagine that we're all extremely cautious. We would never have left Africa. Imagine that we're all extremely risk-seeking. We'd all be dead. What society requires is a distribution of different types. It requires cautious people. It requires risk-taking people. It requires different perspectives. If you think about most of all of the challenges that we currently face, challenges around the future of AI, does anybody actually know what's going to happen next? Of course not. It's radical uncertainty. In worlds of radical uncertainty, you require different perspectives to contribute towards a decision. If any of you have got two or more children, one of the things many parents will say that have two or more children is, my kids are so different. I always use that as like a badge of honor about their parenting. But when it comes to most of how we interact with most other people most of the time, we expect everybody to be like us and to have one perspective, one size fits all. And you know that in brain, the latest neuroscience tells us that it takes way into our mid-20s for the brain to never properly fully develop, but insofar as it develops, it takes into our mid-20s. And you know that perspective taking is the very last bit of the brain. It's why teenagers, if you have teenagers, we've all had rows with our teenagers, you're rowing with a tiny little prefrontal cortex that is unable, really, to adopt the perspective of anybody else other than themselves. And we don't actually really ever stop being teenagers, frankly. We end up in a world where we expect other people to be thinking like us, acting like us, and doing like us. But that is not going to solve any of the radical uncertainty problems that we face, and it's not going to address any of the challenges, because well-functioning societies celebrate difference. And one of the biggest challenges, as all of us who've worked in any institution will know, is groupthink. It's the complete opposite of celebrating difference. It's where we quickly fall in line with a particular perspective or decision, and it's really hard to speak out, even if you disagree with it. In Ash's experiments, the famous social psychologist, even when people could see lines on a board that were so obviously longer than other lines, many people fell in with the stooges in the experiment telling them something different. We want to be like people like us. And groupthink is actually probably one of the biggest challenges to effective decision-making in most organizations and institutions. And if anybody wants to ask me afterwards about one of the motivations for the book, one of the motivations was the inordinate, enormous, and harmful groupthink that took place in the academy and in policymaking in response to COVID. And I'm happy to elaborate on that more in the discussion. If you want the exemplar of groupthink, it was our policy responses to COVID and the academics' views about those responses. But I'm going to instead be more slightly more positive for now, I'm going to talk about how we get out of beliefism. And because, as has been alluded to in the introduction, I'm a very esteemed academic at a very esteemed institution, I came up with the word embrace as the checklist, and then I made the evidence fit the letters of the word, because embrace is a fantastic word. It has seven letters in it. It's a fantastic word because it means embrace. So it's a lovely checklist. And remarkably, I can't tell you how extraordinary this was, George, was it? We were just so incredibly surprised that the evidence fitted perfectly the word that we'd already come up with to begin with. And the reason, joking aside, the reason it's in the form of a checklist is important. Because checklists are a very effective way of drawing us away from a very well-established psychological phenomenon called situational blindness. When you pay attention to something in front of you, it matters because it's in front of you. And you might not be paying attention to what really matters. So if you know anything about the aviation industry, you know that checklists are used on planes, and the pilot has a checklist, which includes, I've got a co-pilot sitting next to me. Check. Because before then, planes would take off without co-pilots. It's pretty unsafe without co-pilot, and more planes would crash than would otherwise be the case because of something that's obvious but overlooked. There's another important behavioral lesson. Many things in life are really obvious, but overlooked. And so what embrace does is it draws us away from our situational blindness and allows us to properly look at how to embed tolerance by design, essentially, into our workplaces, our organizations, and institutions. Because here's the thing, another thing to get over ourselves, we are not going to be tolerant by desire. Everybody thinks they're already tolerant enough. Right, I've decided who I hate, I've decided who I don't hate. It's not for me to be more tolerant, it's for them to be more tolerant. Other people need to be more tolerant, not me. I'm tolerant enough. So it's not going to happen by willing ourselves more tolerant. Just like my first book, Happiness by Design, was a book about how we design environments to be happier, not by willing ourselves happier. So we embed it into our organizations and our institutions. And so I've got a 7-letter checklist. Again, when you read the book, you can see how we can follow through with those elements. I'm going to pick out, because it's in bold type, uppercase, in the list, I'm going to talk a little bit about bonding. Perfect. Thank you so much. So I'm going to talk, I was told 8 minutes, by the way, for those who didn't hear, so you can manage expectations. So bonding is a very obvious insight that there's much more that makes us similar than what makes us different. But if you put two objects next to one another, you look for difference. Similarity is not salient. It's not attentionally salient. So what we need to do in order to allow us to listen to disagreement is to find areas where there is agreement, the things that bring us together. And here is where some of the important determinants of happiness can come in. Music, sport, art, laughter. There are randomized controlled trials showing, and this is very important for universities, Athens, LSE, that if, you know, most illustrious institutions around the world cleanse the learning experience of joy and fun and play. We need to be putting joy, fun, and play much more at the heart of our intellectual discussion because it elevates intellectual discourse. And there's randomized controlled trials showing that humor has to be well-timed and you know, I've learned to my cost a few times at LSE that it's not everything I find funny, other people find funny. But nonetheless, humor is a great way to depolarize, to activate the similarities that we share, and then we can have proper disagreement and discussion about the things that we don't share. And I want to, and by the way, if anyone's ever worked in conflict zones or war zones, music, sport, art are all ways that bring people together, that bond people that would not otherwise dream of being in the same place. So if it can work in conflict zones, it can work at universities and other institutions and corporations. So I just want to finish with music as a bonding tool and just move from a world of beliefism to a world of togetherness or maybe even oneness, which I'll define in a second. I just want to do another, this is just a show of hands, and I really would really appreciate you being very, very honest in answer to this question. You're not going to be shamed if you don't know the following. Do you know who Fatboy Slim is? Put your hands up if you know who Fatboy Slim is. Could you put your hands up if you don't know who Fatboy Slim is? Now, could you leave the room, please? No. So for those of you that don't know who Fatboy Slim is, you will absolutely know his music, which has been played on World Cups and adverts and everywhere around the world. You will know probably the two most famous songs that Fatboy Slim has is a song called Praise You and also a song called Right Here, Right Now. Both of those songs, I guess, and Weapon of Choice, maybe, that's one that's also been used on adverts. Why do I mention Fatboy Slim? Well, Fatboy Slim lives in Brighton, where I live in Brighton. And I'm now going to call him Norman Cook, because that's his name, his real name. And Norman and I have got to know one another this last little while. And we conducted a happiness experiment in Brighton in September, where we collaborated with a company called Polar, who very kindly provided us with wearables. They're a wearable company based in Finland. They gave us a load of wearables plus about 140 chest straps. And so Fatboy Slim played two nights where we had all of the participants that came to the two gigs were with wearables on, chest straps on. We had iPads going around asking people how happy they were. That was a little invasive of their experience. We had thermal imaging cameras that were observing people as they danced. And we're in the process of analyzing those data right now, right here, right now. And What we're looking for, which is, I think, is like super interesting, is finding, if we can find moments of synchronicity between the heart rate variability of people in the audiences. And it doesn't quite in itself show oneness, but it's a good enough for our purposes now as a proxy of when people come together, and you've all witnessed this, you've all experienced it, it doesn't have to be a gig, although it might be, could be a sporting event. Like tonight, I'm going to Olympiacos, Real Madrid. I'm very excited about that. And I'm very excited about that because it clearly annoys the Panathinaikos fans. And I will be jumping around with all of the other Olympiacos fans when they smash Real Madrid. That's the first time you've turned round in the whole of this in the whole of this talk, and it's at that. So we've all experienced it. It's where you feel like you are at one with other people, that it transcends your own experience, sport, music. Arguably, in a world where we're becoming more detached from one another through the use of social media and so on, our desire and our craving for those experiences of true connection is increasing. And we actually see in the UK 4% increase year on year in people attending live sport. We see people willing to pay enormous amounts of money to attend events where they can feel like they're with other people experiencing the same thing at the same time. And think about it, even if you're just watching sport on television and you'd pause it for a second. You want to get live again very quickly, don't you? You want to get live again very quickly in part because you want to feel the same things as the players and fans are feeling at exactly the same time, even if you're in the living room on your own. So you don't have to be at a Fatboy Slim gig in order to feel oneness, although it's a pretty cool place to feel oneness. We should be trying to design connection and bonding into our organizations, into our institutions, in ways that make it just easier for people to feel like they're sharing something together. And if we can do that, then we're a long way towards breaking down many of the other barriers that exist between us. Because the one thing that we all share is a central thermostat that is homeostatic, that is operating on the same homeostatic system, the latest neurobiology tells us, thirst, hunger, and connection. Thirst, hunger, and connection. Connection. We are psychologically, physiologically designed to be around other people. So remind ourselves of what makes us similar and not what makes us different. And then we can properly disagree about some of these issues that we need to disagree about because, final second, well-functioning societies celebrate difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Paul Dolan. Now I would like to invite Professor Labrinis Rory, Professor in Political Analysis at the Department of Political Science and Public Administration of the National Nicopodistrian University of Athens.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for this invitation to discuss with Professor Dolan on this very topical phenomenon described as beliefism. So, Professor Dolan, you define beliefism as discrimination against people who disagree with us, and you develop two levels of analysis, a diagnostic, so how identity and incentives make us other dissenters, and then the remedy, your embrace thesis that we just heard. So I have three points or comments, and then I will try to contextualize your argument in the Greek case by linking it to some phenomena which seem to be very much associated with beliefism. So beliefism as a concept is close to literature on affective polarization, discrimination based on groupthink and intergroup contact, homophily and viewpoint diversity, partisan prejudices. It seems to be that your term functions as an umbrella term, and it permits more nuances, or is rather more inclusive of those yet very similar phenomena. I would like to know how you differentiate from the aforementioned theories, and where does beliefism add explanatory power beyond those? And you also mentioned political polarization in your talk, which is not a new phenomenon. Political polarization is, in fact, in the heart of pluralism and exchange of ideas and antagonism about political programs in liberal democracies are indispensable because one cannot make a choice if all policies converge and all politics, for instance, is consensual. I know that your term, of course, goes beyond politics and applies to practically all fields of human contact and coexistence. But we are now going through an era of democratic backsliding in Western societies. The pace of the rise of illiberalism and of radical, or even more so, reactionary forces, mainly the right-wing edge of the political spectrum, seem to be accelerating in the past 15 years. One of your suggestions is that we need to be tolerant towards divergent ideas and views. And in principle, I agree with you that one should not discriminate or cancel one another on the basis of different beliefs. That said, in the current era, where, for instance, J.D. Vance accused Europeans for not endorsing free speech enough, where conspiracy theories, misinformation, and disinformation are instrumentalized or even weaponized in the name of free speech, could your argument, undeliberately, suggests that tolerant people should become more tolerant, whereas politically intolerant people, who by default cannot or will not or are not willing to become more tolerant, can claim more legitimacy and thus normalize their views by extending their audience? By making use of this argument without giving space, acceptance, or making dialogue with moderate, liberal, and tolerant people. So my question is, how can we embrace people that deny our own rights, our own well-being and freedom? How can we be sure that in this context of the rise of extreme views and undemocratic stances, being tolerant towards the intolerant won't simply increase the pace and the space of acceptance of illiberal policies? And where should being tolerant of dissenters stop? Is there not the boomerang effect? So my third point is about social media and artificial intelligence. You mentioned it and you said we can discuss it in the Q&A, so I might bring some elements in this discussion. We all agree that the proliferation of communication via social media has made this phenomenon of polarization, of uncivil disagreement and hate towards the outgroup, much worse. There is now enough bibliography showing how social media act as megaphones of hate, segregating people, and so on. And of course, this has implications for relations in real life as well. All the more people come into discussions with prefixed opinions and pre-constructed beliefs, and they simply want to confirm and impose their views. We often see it also in class where we teach. Students are extremely opinionated, up to an extent they are not willing to listen to their tutors and lecturers, their co-students, etc. Sometimes they come in class feeling they know everything and are not interested in the learning process or knowing the truth. Thank God not all of them, so a sort of dialogue can take place. So my very pessimistic view is that with artificial intelligence, this tendency will simply become much worse. We already know that with social media and the digital way of living, there is a withdrawal in the cognitive capacity of individuals, especially younger people who have not been through the learning curve yet. They don't have the capacity to deal and process the tons of information that they are exposed to, Also, the attention span is lower. We are all the less capable to concentrate in reading or in a lecture. So with AI, and without the critical thinking that only science and education can provide, we are in front of two different challenges. The first is that individuals who rely their knowledge on ready AI-made arguments and information will not be able to distinguish between right or wrong. The second, which is related to the first, is that this will create even more confirmation bias, which is a need that, to an extent, we all have. But if critical thinking is so absent and people cannot rely on their capacity to judge, by default, they rally around identities, and then beliefism becomes indispensable in order for those fragile inner worlds to exist. In this context, admitting that one is wrong and that the opposite view can have some legitimacy can break one's ego. So am I right to worry that AI will only increase beliefism in the future? And my fourth point is about the Greek case. Let me share some thoughts. Greek political culture has been built on polarization. Greeks have experienced different schisms since the foundation of the Greek state in the 1830s, and especially throughout the 20th century, stark choices have divided society. Just to name the most important ones, a national schism has divided the country in the beginning of the 20th century. The trigger was Greece's participation in World War I, and this divide has structured electoral competition and party politics almost until the Second World War, with the cleavage between liberals and royalists being so deep that society was divided into camps. And then immediately after, and even before the end of World War II, a bloody civil war erupted, which divided the country between communists and anti-communists. This rift had severe political repercussions, and those repercussions for the defeated lasted for decades until a 7-year dictatorship was imposed, which abolished civil rights for the population as a whole. In the aftermath of the 1974 transition to democracy, politicization went hand in hand with political polarization, especially in the 1980s. But this was a polarization that was ideological. It was built on different worldviews. And then Greece experienced an unprecedented economic crisis in the 2010s that divided society deeply, and polarization culminated in a referendum in 2015. One characteristic of that decade, of the crisis, was political violence of all ideological kinds, the far right and the far left, and of different levels of intensity, so mass violence, terrorism, riots, anti-immigrant pogroms, etc. Political violence was a quasi-permanent characteristic during that decade, even if in varying degrees. Since the country exited the bailouts and the economy somehow recovered, a sort of political normality also reappeared. In that sense, in what sense I mean normality? In the sense that we have one-party government, and then that there is also stability, so no snap elections, which was the case during the financial crisis. Also, political violence has decreased, if not withdrawn in the current era. What, however, we observe is that there is now constant polarization in politics and society around any kind of issue. And if we are in search of any spark that can ignite the fire. So to come back to your term, beliefism, it is now all around us. Greeks tend to disagree about everything, and at the same time we deconstruct the opponent with fanaticism, no matter what this is: spousal relationships, friendships, schools, workspace, politics, the public sphere. So polarization is now less about the usual suspects, politics and ideology, but it is more around ideational issues, norms of coexistence, etc. At the same time, we observe a violization in society, if I can use this term. And by that, I mean a rise of all kinds of violence beyond the political version. So we see a rise in domestic violence, school violence, bullying, violence towards minors, who also function as gangs, hooliganism, violence in the streets, even because of bad driving, organized crime. So I would like your comment on this evolution. Does violence have the same psychological trigger or materia prima, no matter how it is finally expressed or where it comes out? And how does this relate to beliefism? And how can we tackle this diffuse, generalized violation of the Greek society? Thank you.
Thank you, Lavrini. I think we'll allow Professor Dolan 5 minutes to respond to these points. Then we'll open it up, and then maybe you want to pick up.
Thank you. Thank you. You can hear me okay. No, thank you. Listen, I mean, it would take more than 5 years to deal with those questions properly. And it ought to, because if everyone gives simple answers to questions, they probably haven't thought about the question properly enough. And so in relation to being tolerant of intolerance, I mean, look, to be clear, I'm not prescribing anything in the book how people ought to interact and how they ought to live their lives. It's just a suggestion that maybe even sometimes people that have the most abhorrent, and this is a hard thing to say, have the most abhorrent and hateful views about one thing may still be worth listening to about how to increase productivity in the workplace or other things that are unrelated to the views that they hold that are abhorrent. But of course, I accept that if people want to actively cause you harm, anybody to engage with them. And in that sense, it makes beliefism somewhat different to other isms. I'm trying to make the case that it's pretty much like other isms when we thin slice people. Hard to think of conditions under which it would be a good thing to be racist, but you can think of conditions under which when people want to actively. So that's an important distinction. On the definition, just very quickly, the most related term would be affective polarization, where we feel hostility towards people who are different. Beliefism can have a more of a cerebral cognitive component to it. And I think it's the spillovers that are the important point. I'm using one categorization of somebody to decide how I'm going to treat them on a wholly unrelated area. I want to just say a couple of words about social media, because when social media was initially in its incarnation, it was truly social media. You were getting feeds on Facebook, for example, from people who would have a much more diverse set of perspectives than the ones that you would only meet in person. We now have algorithmic media. TikTok essentially changed the whole way in which we get our feeds. They're now algorithmic feeds. And other tech companies, Meta included, are using algorithmic feeds. So it ceases to be from a more diverse pool of people and what those channels decide you ought to be listening to. And I agree that that's the biggest change, not the advent of social media itself. And in relation to AI, I kind of broadly agree. I mean, if you think of agentic AI, which is where all the tech bros are searching for your AI advisor, and I've spoken to several about happiness-related advice. You're not going to want an algorithm. You're not going to want your AI advice to say, "Paul, you're being a bit of a dick," or "Paul, you should really listen to those people that disagree with you." I'm probably not going to want to buy into that. So I think there are some significant challenges. If we need to get over ourselves by designing it in our environments, we need to design it well, and that's not an easy thing to do. I'd like to say a couple more comments, if I may, because I think these are important points. I do think the young get a very hard time about social media. I'm often on my phone telling my kids to get off their phone, and I'm sure many parents have witnessed and experienced the same thing. The digital world around us is affecting older people in every way as much as it is affecting younger people. And we we do give our young people. Oh, do I? Sorry. There you go. That's better. Thank you very much for that feedback, literally. So you do get, yeah, I mean, we're all, this sort of narrative that it's all about Gen Z and Gen A, I think, is a mistaken narrative. Which, by the way, if you're thinking about how groups divide themselves, if you, like, imagine putting 100 people in a room from across the age range, from across the socioeconomic spectrum, gender, race, and leave them for half an hour and then go back into the room. How have they divided themselves? Done it by age. The teenagers are talking to one another. The parents are talking to one another. The old people are talking to one another. It's not by race. It's not by gender. It's not by other things that we might obviously think about, the kinds of divisions. Actually, age is probably one of the biggest ones that we have, and that we almost have license to. That you can mock people of a different age much more than you could mock people of a different gender and race. So I just want to just add that note of caution. And then I just maybe make one final observation about heterogeneity and celebration of difference. That celebration of difference also includes not just the beliefs, but how much the belief matters to you. Wouldn't it be, we talk about, and this is for those involved in political science more, we talk about, you know, obviously wanting a more engaged population and getting people, not everybody, it'd be chaos. It'd be absolute chaos. So when we had the Brexit vote in the UK, it became an existential crisis. You had to believe in Brexit or you had to vote to it. What about is I just don't actually care very much, or I've got limited attention or resources. This is something that is not a priority for me to spend my attention on. Whereas interesting, as somebody who broadly fell into that I don't really care very much camp, that was almost worse at LSE around my remaining colleagues than it was to even be in favour of Brexit, because at least Brexiteers have a view about it. I'm like, oh, really? I've got other things. It was 18 of 20 on my list of issues before the referendum. It stayed there broadly afterwards. And you get that looks like Kevin just then, like that. These looks. It's like, you know, I've got other battles to fight. There's other things like football that are much more important. So well-functioning societies celebrate difference, and they celebrate people having different strengths of beliefs, as well as the beliefs themselves. And I think that is everything. Oh, no, except, let me say something about young people as a final point, having said that they're wonderful. One of the really interesting observations that you'll be familiar with, I'm sure many of you, is the segregation that's taking place in dating markets, where, broadly speaking, the world has become a little more progressive if you're a woman, and men have stayed either where they are or even become more conservative than their fathers. And liberal left-leaning women don't want to date conservative-leaning men. And so on top of them being concerned about educational attainment, on top of them being concerned about height, which is an important determinant of women's preferences on dating, sadly for the shorter men, it doesn't affect you, by the way, at all. They're also accounting for politics. And George and I have an experiment with another colleague where we show there's quite a significant premium that people are willing to pay, particularly left-leaning women, in order to date someone who is of a similar political persuasion to them. And this is where I think beliefism, and I'll finish in a second, is the fundamental problem, because we can signal so much about ourselves online and elsewhere now in ways that are costless and in ways that we could never signal before. So when you go on dates, if some of you old enough to remember dating in the real world, you might find out someone's politics after a few dates, by which time you've already decided whether they're kind, funny, generous, rich, or whatever else it is that you might care about. And the politics, it matters, but it's much less important than when you can signal it immediately. So I'd kind of like if we can move to this agentic AI world where we actually find out less about people rather than more straight away, so that then we can start deciding on those factors that really matter to our relationships, to our friendships, in ways that the algorithms might not otherwise forecast. So I think that's enough. That was more than 5 minutes, I apologize.
Thank you, Paul. No, I think that was very interesting. We need to open it up to the audience, and I'm told I'm going to lose my microphone in a second. So please indicate if you want to ask a question. Keep it to a question. We're bound to overrun a bit with time. If possible, introduce very quickly yourselves and ask your questions. The microphone will come.
Thank you. So I'm wondering about your book's intended audience. The title suggests that people want to stop hating people who they disagree with. And I wonder, in your research, is that something you looked at? Do people want to stop hating who they disagree with? And do they distinguish between people close to them or people they don't know?
No, because I won't remember. I'll just very quickly. That's absolutely my point, is that we actually almost feel like we've already decided that we're tolerant enough. So, but to make better decisions, it's all about effective decision making, right, in organizations, institutions, and so on. We do need to be listening to those people that we disagree with more. So we're not going to do it because we want to. We're going to do it because it's designed into the environment for us to do that. And I'll be very quick, my answer.
Thank you, Paul. I'm Daphne Halikiopoulou from the University of York. I disagree with you, but I don't hate you. It's actually possible. So my question is about two interrelated questions. So I was, when you were talking about bonding as the potential solution, yes. I wonder if that has a contradiction inherent in it, right? Because bonding refers to putting people together in a sort of any club, right? Any, whether, you know, we have something in common, but it's impossible to belong to a club without someone being outside the club. So automatically, by making bonding stronger, you also make polarization stronger. And I wonder how you reconcile that. And a second interrelated question is with regards to your, you know, this idea that if we get people, you know, the music, the sport, everything, it gets them to feel it really strongly. And it reminded me of this term in, is it sociology? Collective effervescence. So, you know, people feel yes. that very, very strongly at the moment, but then it goes away. So yes. my question is, how enduring is that?
Super questions. Thank you so much. So, of course, Putnam talked about bonding capital, social capital, bridging social capital, and you're absolutely right. We need to be paying attention to the fact that the bonding could crowd out bridging. I think that's an important point to add. Really, there's absolutely no point of contention there. It's super interesting what you say about that collective effervescence and whether it just like goes. You know, you come out of a club after having had a fantastic time with people that you love to bits, and then 5 minutes later you've kind of, you know, forgotten who they are. And I think that's where we want to maybe bring in some of what we think we know about effective nudges. You know, you have the nudge, but that's not enough. You need the sort of follow-up to activate it in some way. Once you've drawn attention to something, you then need to keep the attention. And so I think that raises a really interesting question about how you keep the effervescence in place. And yeah, no, so yes and yes, I think is probably my short answer to both of those questions.
Yes,
hello.
Thank you. My question basically is, how is the premise of binary thinking occurring to you, because I think that a lot of ink has been shed somehow deconstructing binary thinking, and the most interesting aspect of human communication is the opposite. In other words, the third spaces, Solja wrote about it, in between spaces I wrote about, Derrida would deconstruct this idea of friend or foe. So you started very convinced in a manner of are you with Tsipras or are you a friend of Tsipras or
yeah.
a foe? Somebody could be in different situations, friend, and actually not hate the foes, not be in very aggressive terms with them. So my basic question is about binary thinking. I do not think that people think in binary terms. A lot of people do, about Trump, for example. They would think in binary terms because Trump has a hate speech and therefore makes people friends or foes in any case. The other thing is that binary thinking can be so in certain societies and in certain classes and genders and so on, and different in others. In other words, I wouldn't generalize. That's my question. Why do you think it is generalizable, this aspect of our communication?
Okay, great. Thank you. So listen, I'll try and keep this very, very brief. Of course, context matters. They're two words that come out of my word mouth teaching all of the time. Context matters. There's nothing that is wholly generalizable. One thing I will say, and so I agree with you, one thing I will say about the binary thinking is that we're looking for confirmation most of the time for what we believe we know to be true. We can sometimes do that in nuanced ways, but the simplest way to do that is to represent the alternative perspective as a more extreme caricature and characterization of itself. And we see this a lot in so many studies where you're asked to identify the characteristics of people in the opposite party. And they're always so way much more extreme than the average person is in that party. Because if I can represent the alternative perspective as an extreme view, then it's much easier to win the argument. During COVID, when I came out very, very, very early on publicly questioning in a very measured way the harms that we were causing from the restrictions, I had people attacking me for being a COVID denier, a 5G denier, a vaccine denier, all the things that made it easier to dismiss the nuance of the difference as opposed to engage with that subtlety, which is much harder cognitively.
So, Paul, you mentioned in the beginning complexity as an issue, you know, and that's why, obviously, we use heuristics, because it is too difficult to process the information. So, on the other hand, you present this as a kind of human condition, you know, that we tend to take sides and to kind of cut corners in processing the information. I think I would also speak to the points that Professor Rory raised as well. So, is it that things have become more complex, and that's why we think there's an issue with beliefism, now, whereas, as we heard in Labrinis' presentation, you know, at least in Greece, there was always like a camp, the loyalists, the republicans, the communists, anti-communists, and so forth. So we worry now more because things are more complex and it's more evident that we demonize, if you want.
Such a super question. And again, I don't know would be the most honest answer. What we think is that we notice things more now because there's more platforms and opportunity to notice. So and so our perceptions of the world, which drive a lot of our behaviour, which drive economic behaviour, perceptions matter. So the reality may be somewhat different to the perception, but it's the perception that's driving behaviour. Even if I take the point about violence, I wasn't going to get too much into that. But, you know, arguably, as Steven Pinker makes very compellingly in his book, you know, we're living in the safest possible times of human history. Now, whether we've peaked and things are going to get worse, that's an open question. But at least until very recently, this is the safest world that we've ever lived in. And yet people will talk about narratives about violence. Now, again, whether the data support that or not is actually kind of a moot point. It's much more about our perceptions that really matter. What we do show is that it does appear as if effective polarization has increased. Our views on the issues haven't differed that much. They're not changing that much. We're not that much more polarized on issues, but we are in our hostility towards those people who have different beliefs to us. And I do think that some of the performative nature in which we can engage on social media, and again, to speak to the binary thinking point, facilitates that. You know, I mean, human condition takes the path of least resistance. If I get asked why someone does something, I'll answer because they can, because it's easy to. That's a simple behavioral science 101 lesson, by the way, because it's easy. And if you care about economic inequality, for example, George and I are working on a paper at the moment to show this, and you move to an area of higher income inequality, you hate the opposing parties more than before you moved. Why? Because it's much easier to hate people than it is to actually do something about it.
Okay, thank you. We started a bit late, so we can take a bit of extra time if there's any burning questions. Otherwise, if there are, yes, okay, we'll take a couple of questions, and then I'll tell you about what follows after.
Hello, my name is Angelos Gassenschmidt. I'm a student at the American College of Greece. I just wanted to, just one point on what you said about living in the safest time of, safest age, let's say. I was wondering, maybe this polarization and difference of opinion that we have comes down to maybe people are just bored, you know. They're like, they find, especially through online, let's say, mediums and memes and different forums and on Reddit, if you go in, you see people disagreeing just for the purpose of disagreeing. Like this lady before said about Trump, for example, being one of the most polarizing figures. A lot of people support Trump just because, you know, he's a character or something. So maybe people, let's say, polarize themselves and disagree or agree, not because they really actually believe it, but they sort of get to that belief through the sense of community of the memeing and the sort of this casual exchange. Thank you.
No, thank you. I think it's a notwithstanding, and this is clearly significant, you know, the kinds of polarization that actively cause harm to people. Maybe there is a sort of almost luxury good view to some of the beliefs, is that we've kind of, everything is by and large okay for those people that engage online in particular, that it's a distraction in some sense from other fundamental aspects of life. And I was going to say something else in relation to what you said about Trump. Oh, so I do think sometimes when we look at conspiracy theories, for example, which have arguably, data suggests that there's many more people believing in conspiracy theories. I'm not sure whether all of those people actually really believe it. It's just that they kind of like to be seen as the kind of person who believes it. And I think that's where identity matters. You know, like the flat earth society. I mean, actually very many people think the earth is flat anymore, but it's kind of funny to be in a group of people that say that they think it is. And I think that probably speaks to that point quite well, I think.
Thank you, Paul. I was with you until you mentioned about the Brexit referendum.
I could see your face. You went red.
Yes. You mentioned that, perhaps counterintuitively, Brexit was something like the 18th or 20th issue you thought was important, but you voted. I wonder to what extent the intensity of feeling should be related to political participation, because clearly with the Brexit referendum, a whole new strata of people participated in the referendum that don't normally vote at an election, but they did vote in the referendum. It's a good thing that people voted in that referendum who thought that the issue didn't really matter, whereas the rest of us thought it was existential.
Well, they're spoken like a true Remainer who was looking for any way to find sense in the fact that more people voted to leave than voted to remain. It's an interesting question, Brexit aside, about whether intensity of preference should inform voting. I mean, there's been a whole literature of that, of course, for, you know, decades. I know this is doing an injustice to whoever it was who said, you know, democracy is the worst of all systems until you compare it to all the other systems. And one person, one vote, in spite of all of its ills, is probably a good thing. A more interesting question, perhaps, or an interesting question that follows from that is whether we might make voting compulsory. So that if you go into the ballot box, you have to actively decide not to vote for any of the candidates. And whether that might increase the quality of politicians, because, or at least start to promote the quality of politicians. Because one thing that nearly every politician of whatever political persuasion in the UK I've spoken to over the last three decades has said is that the regard for politicians has diminished significantly to the point at which if you were a good quality person, you don't go into politics anymore in a way that 30 years ago people did. And that's I think, something that we need to pay much more attention to, I think. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the wonderful talk. Your lecture actually has a starting point, the individual psychology. And personally, being a professor of political sociology, I have as a starting point society. So I really wonder how, when social cleavages deepen and deepen, how adequate is it to have as a starting point just individual psychology and not analyze trends in society and the disintegration of social coherence? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. What a super question. Well, that speaks to interdisciplinary conversations and interdisciplinary research, and it speaks to incentives in academia to be better aligned to that interdisciplinarity, which largely they're not. They're largely aligned, like so many organisations and workplaces, into silos of your disciplines and your areas of expertise, so that people working in related fields actually aren't having conversations with one another about how to advance. It's clearly going to be both. It's clearly going to be a complex interaction between society and individuals, and that's where the action really, really ought to be if we're going to address many of these challenges and issues. That feels like a very incredibly conciliatory point on which to finish, but I don't want to finish on a conciliatory point. I want to finish on football, because it is like the most important thing in the world. And I have to make a nod to Panathinaikos, otherwise I'm not allowed back in the country. It was literally what I had in my ears. And so on that note, I will love to join you for a drink before going off and watching Olympiacos beat Real Madrid. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for being here with us. You are now invited to join us by the yard for cocktails.